The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. Using science to debunk myths. From the pandemic to climate fraud. Thanks for listening to Sky Dragon Slaying on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the show. We have with us three times Pulitzer Prize nominee Martin Seif, who was columnist for The Globalist since 2002. He's appeared as expert on Asia, Pacific affairs and Middle East and National Public Radio. Been on Fox News Channel, C-SPAN. He's done a lot, really. American Conservative, The Wall Street Journal, Commentary, National Review, National Review Online. You know, it's endless. Martin, you've got such a wide, diverse career. You know, you're considered a man of high intellect, and you study things very intently, and you know, you do give us great analysis. We don't agree with everything you say, because who does? But you know, nobody agrees on everything. But what we do agree on is that we're living in a new world now. It seems to be the demise of the unipolar world, and of course, the unipolar world, that's mainly the United States, run from London and also from Washington. The multipolar world, the BRICS nations, they're coming to the fore. Tell me, what's your take on this? Do you think that's a good thing? Do you think it's all for the good or not?
In a way, it is inevitable, first of all. Yeah. And there is a book I recommend on this. It came out 30 years ago, very mainstream book, by a great scholar, British scholar who came to America, Professor Paul Kennedy, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And what he did was he looked at global history starting in the West and spreading because of the advanced technology of the West across Asia and then across Africa and the Southern Hemisphere too, of the past 500 years of global politics and conflict. And he discerned a pattern. Nations grew strong with dominant economies and advanced technology, even if they were smaller in size, like France or Britain. They then developed major empires. They then, as Spain did, first of all, and then France and Britain and America, and attempted Germany too afterwards, to become global empires. But and then the Soviet Union made the same mistake. Whenever they became the most powerful or believed themselves to be the most powerful nation in the world, they believed they had the power and the right to direct the whole world in the way, for its own happiness, in the way of their own political system. And they failed every time. And all that happened was they drained their own strength. And if you talk to any Russians in Russia over the past two generations about communists, communism is not coming back in Russia. There is a very strong nationalism, which could be very dangerous for the West. It's becoming very dangerous for the West in Russia. Yeah. I don't want to sound sweet and naive and uncritical about that. Last thing in the world we should be. But when Russians look back at communism, they have nothing but contempt for Brezhnev and Khrushchev. Yeah. And the reason they say they do is, they say our economy collapsed. It was a joke. Our people suffered because these idiots were insistent on bringing the blessings of communism, so-called, all the way across Asia and the Middle East and Africa and Latin America, and they neglected their own country. Now these same Russians look at the United States and they say, you're making the same mistake we did, and you're going to fail, and you have been failing the same way we are. And this is all in Professor Kennedy's book, The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. And when it came out, neoconservatives who were triumphant in America in those days under President George Herbert Walker Bush, and much more so under his son afterwards, the father, Joe is right, the father was a very powerful, significant, not a fool at all, but a dangerous man and a powerful man. Very powerful man. But the son was just an idiot, and was an idiot who was happily influenced by so-called intellectuals around him, just as we see what's happening with Boris Johnson, just as we see it's happening with Joe Biden and with Barack Obama and with most of the Republicans too. Same thing. These people, as professional politicians, think that they're superior to ideas, and they don't have the brains to think them through anyway. So they subcontract it out. They take ideas, and they only take ideas from phonies, first point. Secondly, Your point is crucial, John. We're human beings. We are a diverse species, not just race. It isn't just an American or British or Russian, Chinese or African thing. It's a human thing. We are a diverse species. We are at our best when we argue with ourselves and thrash out messy compromises that are not intellectually sweet and pure and ideal. And actually, democracy is a marvelous forum for that. It's never going to bring justice. It's never going to clear the world of corruption. But it's still relatively endlessly more humane and efficient in the long run than any of the alternatives. But it is not ideal. And anyone who wants it ideal is going to end up being bitter and hateful and cynical and fall for the Soros of this world and fall for the communists of this world and fall for the Islamic fundamentalists of this world. But these shortcuts only end up one way, with genocide. Mm-hmm. My teacher taught me this, the late Sir Isaiah Berlin, the greatest expert on the history of political philosophy and thought on the 20th century at Wolfson College, Oxford, which he founded in the 1960s. And Berlin taught that any effort to impose a single view of wisdom or humanity or conventional thinking, be it communism or capitalism or anything, any attempt to create a utopia, according to Plato, of course, would automatically create genocide and hell on earth instead. This is the golden rule. Never try to create heaven on earth. You will always create hell on earth instead. And this is why TNT is so necessary, because the British and American medias and Western European democratic media, and this was their glory, were full of squabbling, independent, messy views up to the 1960s or 70s, later, I think, in Britain even. But in America, it ended in the 1950s and 60s, and not through conscious suppression or I used to lecture on this. I studied this carefully. I came into the American media when this process was still developing and accelerating. Because of economic forces, capitalism out of control and unregulated, which Reagan let it be, the last remaining independent centers were allowed to be bought over by bigger corporate conglomerates, or they came together. So you still have theoretically about half a dozen of them, but that's a few enough of them to form a club and to create a consensus between them. So you have a single agreed view of reality, and it is never questioned. But democracy like science and freedom like science require open debate and continual questioning of previously held assumptions, because the world is always changing. And this is true whether you are of the right or of the left. The world is always changing, so we need open debate. So by ending open debate, which they have done so successfully for us, and which we have done to ourselves, because most people don't want open debate. What most people simply want to be believe that they are right and everybody else is wrong, or they and the overwhelming majority, we're all on the right side of history. But you see, that's the danger. If the future of history is democracy and open markets as defined in Washington, D.C. and New York and Wall Street, then anything is justified in shutting down debate in America, and anything is justified at destroying the governments of China and Russia and Iran and any country around the world, and Japan, any country, or Germany or France, any country around the world that disagrees with our version of it. I cracked a joke about this 35 years ago. I never thought my joke would come true. I said the neoconservatives really believe in democracy, but their definition of democracy is that everybody must do exactly what they tell them to do. And I never dreamed that successive governments of the United States, both Republican and Democratic alike, would buy this pathetic, contemptible, ludicrous, infantile piece of shit. But they have. And therefore, we're heading towards a world war. Because we are facing...
Look at these press conferences by Biden. What do you think of these press conferences by Biden, where he basically says to the American people that if you vote a Republican, you're not an American?
I feel the same way you do. It's contemptible. And I cite again one of the most famous fascists, and arguably he wasn't one really, because he wasn't part of the Smedley-Butler conspiracy, Joe rightly pointed out before in the 1920s. But President Roosevelt thought he was a great threat, rightly, to democracy if he ever became president of the United States. He died in 1935. And that was Governor, later Senator, Huey P. Long of Louisiana, a demagogue, but a brilliant demagogue. And he, like so many demagogues, especially from the Old South, he had a great wit to him. And he wasn't a racist. He defended black people and Jewish people. He was a great figure for tolerance. At a time, it was very dangerous and unpopular to be a tolerant figure. So let us give him genuinely earned credit for that. But before he was killed in a bungled shooting, he was accidentally, I can go into this in more detail, but obviously isn't the time to do so. But it was not the cause of a conspiracy, because of his own stupidity and that of his guards. He was accidentally shot in an accidental shootout in the state capital of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. But before he died, when he was still thought he could become president of the United States, Huey P. Long was once asked, could fascism take over America? Remember, this is the time of Mussolini, the time of Hitler, a time when there was even more concern that democracy had collapsed and failed and could not work than we even see so far today. And what was Huey P. Long's answer? Sure, fascism can take over America. Easy. Only one thing, though. It'll be called anti-fascism. And this makes Joe Biden the perfect Huey P. Long definition of a fascist, somebody who destroys democracy and freedom in the name of defending democracy and freedom. And of course, he's not the first to do so. Many of them have. But the one who did so most egregiously and shamelessly and contemptibly was George Herbert. The second Bush, George W. Bush, with the witless, contemptible Patriot Act of 2001. And let us not forget the Magnitsky Act as well, brought through by Senator Ben, pushed through by Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, who I never voted for, but who I was stuck with. There are great advantages, of people always tell me, in moving from Maryland to New Jersey. Not the least of them is, at least, I'm not represented by Ben Cardin anymore. But the Magnitsky Act was used against legitimate drug smugglers and international criminals, but it was has also been used to shut down debate. And to shut down and delegitimize international sources. And you may well find one day it will be turned on TNT radio. It would not surprise me. I hope it will not be. I've already been a victim of the Magnitsky Act in other outfits outside the United States that I was stupid enough. I'm proud of having appeared on them and having them take me. But in conventional terms, it's the same justification. The only way to defend democracy is to shut down democracy. The only way to save free speech is to destroy free speech. George Orwell would have understood this double speak in 1984 very, very well.
Yeah. Joe Olson, you've got a wonderful quote to back that one up, haven't you, from Whitney Webb?
Oh, yeah. She's got a 900-page book, One Nation Under Blackmail. And somebody that we posted repeatedly from James Fetzer's site, Hakeem Hagopon, has a 5-volume set, 2,500 pages long, called Pedophilia and Empire. And he goes back thousands of years with thousands of footnotes referencing all of the demonic things that go on with our, quote, leadership worldwide. And we just put up with this. And so that's part of the problem. They think that they're omnipotent and they've got us where we don't challenge them. And so if you don't challenge them, then they can continue to feel that way. But Whitney Webb is an excellent reporter and she's done dozens of interviews. You won't have any problem if you just put in One Nation Under Blackmail and then put Whitney Webb and then search videos. You'll find dozens of interviews with her and she's extremely knowledgeable and articulate. Great person to expose what's really going on.
Yeah, I want to jump in with another thing that I think may be worth considering is that, we talk about the elite, we talk about the billionaire class who run this, and I picked up on a study on psychopathy, and the study explains why psychopaths are so successful. It's from C.W. Healy back in May 2020. And it gives a really good rundown of why people in power are often psychopaths. And, you know, it boils down to their narcissism, lack of empathy, disinhibition, and egotistical desires. And I think that pretty much sums up most politicians, doesn't it, Martin? Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, I think it sums up the politicians at the top. And most politicians below them are simply sheep who literally swallow everything they are given. When I was 19 and I was a first year student at Oxford, I felt very strongly, not about Vietnam. My cause of the time was the genocide of 3 million people of the Igbo tribe in Biafra in the Nigerian Civil War. And it quickly became clear that the governments of the US, the Soviet Union, and Britain were all on the same side. They were perfectly happy to see millions of people being killed just to clear the way for their oil company operations in Nigeria. That the poor Igbo people somehow, like the Ukrainian people today, they found themselves in the way of a certain demented version of history. I mean, you can find yourself in the path as the Jewish people did, the Russians in World War II, and the Polish people in the direct path of the Nazi Germany, of the genocide of Stalin, his many genocides. But it's never good to be find yourself stuck in the face of a general idea, which doesn't care how many millions of people it slaughters. And I had a chance. I joined the Oxford University Labour Party just to attend a meeting with the then Foreign Secretary of Britain, another brainless idiot, because I saw this at first hand, Michael Stewart, totally forgotten figure now, who throughout his career was regarded as a decent man, an honourable man, solid fellow, the kind of fellow we need in politics. And I asked him, you're always talking about compassion in politics, Mr. Stewart, but how can you possibly justify the policies you direct as Foreign Secretary that have starved 1 million children to death in West Africa in the past 2 years? And it went on for the next year. His answer astounded me. And he discussed it with me privately after the meeting, too. He was totally sincere. He said, oh, these are agonizing choices to make, heartbreaking choices. But of course, he made them. But if we didn't do it, a general principle would be broken. All the countries of Africa would fall apart, and there would be far worse suffering if we did not support the government of Nigeria, this, that, and the other. Now, everything he said was nonsense, was idiocy. And he knew nothing about Africa, its history, its sociology, and he didn't want to know.
Right.
But he went in the direction that the big financial interests that wanted him to go, and he asked no questions, and he didn't care who got in the way. He was a contemptible little bag of shit, and if there's any justice, he'll be burned. He's been burning, screaming in the depth seventh circle of Dante's hell for the past 30 or 40 years or since he died.
Yeah.
But I suspect he isn't, and maybe if you and I and Joe and our friends get into the afterlife, we can throw him there, where he belongs. But otherwise, in this world, there is no justice unless people make it so. And it's almost impossible to bring it about, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. The general thing, the point you're making, though, is that the sheep, those with the lack of willpower, they don't have the confidence, they don't have the hubris to stand up for themselves. They don't, do they?
And therefore, they follow the psychopaths. Yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. And we'll talk about Ted Bundy, we'll talk about Jeffrey Dahmer, but as you say, compared to the Hillary Clintons of the world, the Zelenskys of the world and so forth, you know, these are small fry, aren't they? They really are chicken feed. They're amateurs by comparison. Joe Olson, I mean, what's your take on this idea that psychopaths rule the roost in terms of politics? Do you find that yourself?
Oh, yeah. The whole system is designed by psychopaths to promote and enrich psychopaths. And if you watch the series on America's Untold Stories, I mean, they go into a whole range of these things. And everybody involved, you can see the enormous sociopathic behavior of these people. And they recognize it among themselves. And then they say, hey, you look like you'd make a good murderer or a good thief or a good liar. So why don't you come join us? And so together, they've created a whole system that rewards that type of behavior, and they've been able to corrupt the justice system to the point where there's no other way around it. You have absolutely no legal recourse. Look at all the obvious voter fraud that happened in 2020, and every jurisdiction, 50 or 60 different lawsuits were brought, and the judges said either you didn't have standing or you know, that it wouldn't have made any, no material difference to the outcome. And so basically nobody was able to present any facts. And so until this stuff is starting to come out in Twitter, you didn't realize, some people didn't realize the enormous extent of racketeering that creates the government that we're supposedly blessed with. It's absolutely shocking, but that's where we are.
That's where we are. This is TNT Radio. We'll be right back after this ad break.
TNT Radio's Jeremy Nell.
This is why I think they're bringing in so much of this AI stuff, is to try and get rid of these human decisions that are made, particularly in warfare.
Do you think a lot of that is by design or just by emergence or perhaps a combination of the two?
Well, okay, so the, many of the policymakers and the financial people can't get ordinary people or corporations even to do what they want. I think that's really what it is. And so they want, they have these various ambitions like intimidation and surrounding of China and North Korea, for example. And there's pushback within the military against this for very sensible reasons. To a certain extent, you know, it's just to do with self-preservation, saying, well, we don't want a war, with unwinnable war, thank you very much. I think at the back of all of this, if you really want to peel away the layers of the onion, right in the core of it is the this whole idea of game theory. And what's happened over the decades, certainly the decades since the Second World War, is that much of the geostrategic thinking has been about playing it as a game. And if it's a game, then you can tweak things and potentially you can win the game.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Let's take advantage of the freedoms that we have while we have them to advance the kingdom's objective, to be salt and light.
Freedom is hard. Election security involves you, involves the voters.
This election, for people of faith, is vital that we see a change, because the war against Christians is at an all-time high.
Transparency is the key not only to having honest elections, but to maintaining public trust in those elections.
Our ability to vote is not being withheld from us. No one's trying to stop you from voting.
The one place the American people can have a say is at the ballot box. That's why the Democrats and the far left are working so hard to get rid of all election integrity.
We cannot let our elections be anything but transparent. It is at the very heart of freedom in a free society.
And if we lose America, I mean, it's all over, because the world has looked to America for hope.
Free and fair at salemnow.com.
Billionaire globalist corporations will own everything.
Homes, factories, farms, cars, furniture, and everyday citizens will rent what they need, if their social credit score allows.
Lighting the fuse for freedom, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. We're entering the last half hour of the show with Martin Seif. And, you know, we talked earlier in the show about Twitter, Elon Musk, the importance of social media, and the importance of getting information out there. TNT Radio, we've been hit by censorship. We don't get a fair shake on social media. Principia Scientific, Joe Olson, you and I have been on the game with Principia Scientific for 12 years. Endless censorship. We've been banned on different platforms. There is hope that Musk taking over Twitter on the principle of bringing in free speech is going to be helpful. And there are three words to add to that that might be a sign of things changing. And those three words are Hunter Biden laptop. Now, those three words scare a lot of people. Martin Seif, those three words, what do they mean to you?
They mean the same thing they mean to you and Joe John. They mean the lid off a monstrous pot and dangerous pot of corruption. It was right to look at Donald Trump and hold everything he did under a microscope. The world would have been a much more dangerous place had this not been done. The same principle needs to be applied to Joe Biden. It's as simple as that. And again, we come back to this issue of freedom of speech and diversity, which is absolutely central. And you, John, have just practiced this in an admirable way. Joe made many brilliant and striking points before. I disagreed strongly with several of them. You let me do that. So did Joe. That's the way it should be.
Yes.
Open debate. Open debate, yes, from people who have different points of view. And let when I was on the Washington Times newspaper, it was a very biased newspaper, had a strong national American ultra-conservative Republican bias. But this was necessary because the dominant Washington Post and New York Times, far more vast newspapers with vaster, infinitely vaster reaches than we had, with infinitely vaster resources and 100 times as many reporting resources as we did, and financial resources, 1,000 times more financial resources at least than we did, they were very liberal. And therefore, one needs a conservative counterweight, just as in times of conservative dominance, one needed a liberal counterweight. Like Joe, I'd like to have the excuse to say, I share with him my enormous admiration for Matt Taibbi, who used to be with Rolling Stone. Matt Taibbi has broken so many crucially important stories that so many of the rest of us did not even dream were there in his eminent career. And his exposure of the truly ugly background of Mitt Romney, who was at least six times wealthier than he publicly, modestly, of course, claims to be. And all that money is made, as Joe rightly pointed out, from smashing these otherwise highly successful companies, destroying the jobs and livelihoods and literal families of hundreds of thousands of American people, and then feeling virtuous about it. And then lecturing other political leaders for lacking his fine sense of morality. This is something Charles Dickens already recognized nearly 200 years ago in his classical novels. The hypocrisy of the sanctimonious hypocrites. I had the privilege to meet the movie star George Clooney about 20 years ago when he brought out a marvelous movie, actually about censorship, called Good Night and Good Luck, about the McCarthy era in the United States. And Clooney personally is a nice man. He is a gracious, friendly man. He was nice and gracious even to non-entities like myself. One of my curious observations over my quite long life so far has been that Hollywood produces a far higher, superior life form in its movie stars than Washington does in its political stars. Washington political stars will treat every human being like shit. Won't even bother hiding their disdain. Hollywood movie stars, even if they feel it, have the good manners not to show it and treat people with courtesy. This is an enormously important difference. Enormously important difference. Whatever you agree or disagree with about the political views, they are manipulated or brainwashed or influenced to hold for better or worse. And George Clooney made a very interesting point. He said, I am a liberal. And I strongly believe that liberalism is an honorable and admirable word that needs to be reclaimed, whose meaning needs to be reclaimed. Now, I'm sure I would disagree with him, and I'm sure you would too, and I'm sure Joe would as well, about what admirable factors need to be reclaimed. One could argue about those things till we're blue in the night. But he was an honorable man, and he had the George Wellian insight to see that political terms have been corrupted or have become meaningless by the way they have evolved, the way as our society has degenerated. And we need to reclaim our language. Yeah, Joe's just pasted up in the chat room here a wonderful quote from Rush Limbaugh, of all things. And it's perfect that politics is for the unattractive. I'm sorry, I may have garbled that, Joe, but I do love the sentiment. That is so true. That is so true. But there has to be open debate. There has to be, and that means open disagreement and the courage to disagree. And the permission to do what you've already practiced, John, routinely, and you take for granted, to let your guests argue with each other or take different viewpoints. Otherwise, it's meaningless. And of course, PBS is meaningless. And CBS is meaningless. And CNN is certainly meaningless.
Yeah, and we come back to the point that the Hunter Biden laptop, it's been on the scene in the background for a few years now, and people have tried to bring it to the forefront and failed.
Yes.
And mid-October, you know, finally, perhaps we're going to get some traction. Marco Polo Group, again, they're led by President Trump's staffer, and they sent details of the investigation to all 535 members of the U.S. House and Senate. District attorneys and U.S. attorneys have all had a look at it, in theory. And it looks as if it contains 140 alleged business-related crimes, 191 sex-related offenses, and 128 drug-related crimes, all linked to the Biden family. Now, this is astronomical, isn't it? This is incredible material, if it's tangible, if it's credible, and it's certainly got that smell of being credible, because people are fearing it, aren't they? They've been suppressing it for so many years now, and the man to perhaps break it into the public domain at the perfect time could be Elon Musk, because Elon Musk has the stature. You know, he has fans on the left and the right, doesn't he? He's unique. Unlike Trump, Elon Musk is respected as a man who stands for green. He stands for the idea of progress, SpaceX and Tesla. But also he stands for entrepreneurship, capitalism. So he covers a lot of bases, and he will have a wide audience. And what a better platform than Twitter if, is it quite a big if, everything does come out on that platform. Because Twitter, let's be fair, Twitter is so influential in politics. People are now admitting that Zuckerberg and so forth, all these people on Facebook and so forth, they control the narrative when it comes to elections, don't they, Martin? They really do have a major input in how the votes are cast.
Oh, yes. I mean, the biggest one of all, I think, is even bigger in terms of political impact in Britain and America. And that is on the putative right, not the left. And that's Rupert Murdoch, who in his mid-90s is still going strong and still happily manipulating elections. I mean, the Sun newspaper, which you know so well in England, I once heard 30 years ago a wonderful definition of it, that it was written by geniuses to be read by idiots. And very crucial point there. And I'm like you, I am a great admirer of Elon Musk, and I don't agree with all of his positions on everything or anything, but you see there something that George Orwell felt was the most important value imaginable, that he celebrated, for example, in Charles Dickens, and that is that Elon Musk is his own man, and this makes him a threat to these people. And meaning him well as I do, I would give him two pieces of genuinely heartfelt and sincere positive advice. First, take the greatest care over his personal security, especially over where and what he eats and what the food sources are. And secondly, never fly in a private plane, because too many of them go down for natural reasons anyway. So when any of them go down for unnatural reasons, it's much more tempting to try to arrange it, and you're much more vulnerable doing it. A remarkable number of politically inconvenient people, including United States senators, have died in quote-unquote tragic small plane crashes over the past 50 years, including the head of Enrico Mattei, the head of the Italian oil industry. I think that's an area Joe would, these are areas of targeted assassination that Joe knows vastly more about than I do. But we need Elon Musk, and by being as courageous and honest and outspoken and simply as complex as he is, because he is an enthusiastic green environmentalist. He is doing things that the political left loathe on Twitter. He is not fitting neatly into the box of left and right. And precisely because he was previously seen as being a quote-unquote progressive, that makes him much more of a danger to the progressive side of the fence and to malevolent people on that side of the fence. There are plenty of malevolent people on the right side of the fence, but they have other people to hate like me.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, Joe Olson, do you want to chip in with that one?
Oh, yeah. Rupert Murdoch married one of Mick Jagger's wives, a beautiful lady from Dallas area named Jerry Hall. And I was expecting, I was expecting her to put him in a commas in no time. But apparently she doesn't have the magic she used to have. Basically,
or he has more magic.
Yeah, that's right. If she lived with him, she could handle anything. So
exactly.
I was extremely disappointed with the war on coal that Obama did. And I was a subscriber for a while to a magazine called Workboat, and they have a lot of traffic on the Mississippi River is coal. And the wonderful thing about coal is you can stockpile it. You know exactly what the BTU content is per ton of coal, and you know how many days of burn you get out of it. And so you can stockpile, and most plants did, 3 months supply of coal. So you could go through rivers being frozen, railroad tracks being covered. We had nothing but natural gas because they shut down all the, most of the coal-fired plants in Texas. And so when you have a little bit of a power interruption, then the, you don't have the ability to run your gas pumps, because the pumps on gas pipelines used to be powered by gas engines, but they decided, oh, we'll just switch them over to electric. They're quieter and less maintenance. Well, then they didn't notify the electric grid that those were critical infrastructure, and those pumps quit running, and so you quit had the supply. And plus the vulnerability from, but the other thing that was mentioned in Workboat is when Obama took office in 2008, the U.S. coal industry had a market cap value of $40 billion. After just 2 or 3 years of him attacking them, it had dropped to $400 million, which is a 90% reduction in the capital investment by the stockholders and the owners of the company, and a loss of jobs. And then what happened? The same robber barons that run the whole show, like Warren Buffett, go in and buy them up at 10 cents on the dollar because they made it worth 10 cents on the dollar. And then they said, well, we won't use it domestically, but we'll ship U.S. coal to China. It's like, why is this an environmentally wonderful thing to do? The whole thing is just we're run by idiots that are manipulated by demons. And that's the problem we've got.
Well said, yep. Joe Olson. We're going to cut to another break now. It's TNT Radio. We'll be back after this ad break.
Bye-bye, humans, according to the World Economic Forum advisor. Oh, boy.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
World Economic Forum advisor Yuval Noah Harari says humans as we know them today will cease to exist within 1 to 200 years. Why? Because humans will be hacked, Harari explains.
We will use advanced technology, biotechnology, nanotechnology, direct brain-computer interfaces to upgrade Homo sapiens into different kinds of beings, beings which are different from us much more than we are different from Neanderthals.
Are you looking forward to a direct brain-computer interfaces to upgrade yourself? Are you ready for humans to be hacked by the World Economic Forum? Klaus Schwab has even called for human brain implants to monitor our moods and thoughts. Don't be hacked. Reject the Great Reset. Let's call it the Great Reject. Reject hacking the human mind. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Natural disasters may seriously threaten civilization in future. Yet the mainstream media peddles a pseudo-scientific man-made climate crisis. A major cosmic event would provide a real challenge for civilization. An asteroid strike may induce an ice age and major crop failures. And a solar coronal mass ejection that knocks out much of the world's electrical and communications systems would make today's problems look trivial. A solar coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetosphere in September 1859 and induced the largest geomagnetic storm on record. People in northeastern United States could read a newspaper by the light of the aurora borealis. Telegraph systems failed, and some telegraph operators received electric shocks. If such a solar storm happened today, power grids, GPS systems, telephones, and the internet could be disabled for an extended period.
Don't forget and don't forgive. Punish those who hurt people with COVID madness. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back. With us, Martin Seif, the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Middle East, Shifting Superpowers, the U.S.-China-India Relationship in the 21st Century, and another book, The Cycles of Change, the Three Great Cycles of U.S. Political History, and The War and Peace in the 21st Century. Martin, you've done so much work, you've studied so much, you've written extensively. One thing we haven't mentioned that we mentioned in a previous show is the idea of catastrophe theory. We just heard on the ad break there that coronal mass ejections, asteroid strikes, all these things are now coming to the fore. You know, you studied this in great detail, haven't you? Catastrophe theory is very close to your heart. Give our listeners a little taste of what you could tell us about that.
I find myself more isolated on this now in my 70s than I was even in my early 20s, and I was a laughing stock among intellectual friends about it even then. But the problem with catastrophe theory is not the lack of evidence, but A, that there is so much evidence, and B, that it operates within human history, because there are major scholars who have written on this. The main problem is not finding the evidence. The main problem is that people are frightened of acknowledging the evidence. There is a deep-rooted fear that Sigmund Freud and his followers recognized, or they didn't recognize, most of them didn't recognize where it was from, but they recognized it was there in the human race, in confronting the past history of the human race, and above all else, in the origin of religion, to protect us from destruction from the heavens. Why? Well, actually, archaeology gives us a key for this. If you look at every major archaeological site that is built and rebuilt over itself successively over thousands of years, and this is an insight now confirmed by the most recent studies in DNA as well, we find that human existence around humans, civilizations, human cities are repeatedly around the world wiped out simultaneously. Huge levels of ash or sand fall in the world. There is human tradition that much of the deserts of Saudi Arabia and North Africa were not created by goats grazing on land, because Arabs were so simplistic and subhuman as to not understand how to look after their land. That's ignorant, racist nonsense. What we instead find is that there are great human catastrophes that turn great catastrophes apparently from things like asteroids falling or flybys from other bodies that dropped vast quantities of material on the Earth. 60 years ago, scholars called Giorgio Santillana and Hertha von Deschen wrote a book called Hamlet's Mill, a hard reading and a bizarre book, but its conclusions were overwhelmingly scholarly and accepted, and so overwhelming that they had to be ignored immediately, which was that throughout ancient cultures, the skies were seen as producing falls of endless quantities of material on the earth, which drowned civilizations within the human record, within human tradition, and that human survivors reported this, but that the memory of these things was so terrifying that later traditions reinterpreted these events. And the late Emanuel Velikovsky, who was regarded as a crackpot, although he worked with people like Chaim Weizmann, the founder of the Hebrew University, one of the world's leading chemists, who became first president of the State of Israel, and he also worked closely with Albert Einstein and many others, produced a book in 1950 called Worlds in Collision, arguing that there had been these huge catastrophes between different planets of the solar system having near flybys with each other, even in the historical record on the Earth. And the book was laughed at. But there was a problem. Velikovsky made a series of predictions in the book. He said Venus will be found beneath its atmosphere to rotate in the opposite direction from every other planet in the solar system, which was impossible at the time and nobody else believed. He said elements of the atmosphere of Mars, like neon, will be found in the craters of our own moon. How did they get there? He said that elements of water consistent with water on Earth will be found in moons and asteroids throughout the solar system, which should have been impossible, and yet they have been. And all of these were not blind guesses. They were all based on his interpretation of ancient texts describing the interactions of planets in the ancient past, which were defined as gods. And he wrote a book called Earth in Upheaval, which I recommend to everyone here to start with in his books, Earth in Upheaval, because it simply goes into the geological record and it shows how even Darwin had to face the problem. How come we find on top of the Andes Mountains in South America and on top of the Himalayas element, huge quantities of shells, plankton, fossilized sea life. How could giant waves bring animal life and fish and vegetable life from the bottom of the sea and put them on top of mountains 4 or 5 miles high? This is because gigantic tides were raised in historical times, and they are described in all historical records. And Velikovsky says people who have survived these incredible events were not in denial about them. They recorded them as sacred history. But the what they wrote was so terrifying to later generations that later generations refused to recognize what they read. So the Bible, for example, is misread. In the book of Psalms, where King David, as the psalmist, writes about mountains dancing like rams and hills like lambs, everyone says, oh, that's poetic metaphor. He's a poetic genius. Velikovsky says, no. He wasn't a poetic genius. He was an eyewitness. He was describing events that he saw with his own eyes. When he talks about lava flowing or mountains melting, he was seeing mountains melting, or other people were as well. Now, I come from a fundamentalist society in Northern Ireland, and I am not a fundamentalist, Christian or otherwise, but I am a literalist. The influence of that is very deep with me. And it informs my political analysis and my historiographical research as well. I am very much a literalist. And as a result, I often see things that people who are far higher IQs than I do, and are far more eminent than I am, are too brilliant and sophisticated to see. It helps, like Isaac Newton said, to see yourself as a 5 or 6 year old little boy kicking pebbles along the shore. It helps to reduce elements to their basics. And this is the essence of catastrophe. And what you have just said, John, bless you, is, look, we have evidence of either cosmic disasters or biological catastrophes sweeping the human race within the past 200 years alone. You have just mentioned one, the extraordinary electrical storm of 1859, which today, if we had it at the same level, would be chaotic. There was the New Madrid earthquake along the not far from St. Louis, along the Mississippi River in about 1805 or 1806, I think, maybe 1803. I stand to be corrected on the date. But if that took place today at the same level on the Richter scale that it did 220 years ago, we would have multiple millions of people dead within the United States. We live on a far more unstable, fragile planet, in a far more unstable, unpredictable solar system and universe than we dare to acknowledge. And that is the simple bottom line. And then you have the liars like Carl Sagan, who bend over backwards to sneer at and persecute the many courageous scientists who are out there who do put these unfashionable truths together. And one good place to start was an extraordinary American genius who died 100 years ago in New York City, completely unknown in his own lifetime, which didn't bother him at all. He was a recluse. But he was called Charles Fort, F-O-R-T. And he wrote a book called The Book of the Damned. Now, this book had nothing to do with demons or black magic or Satan or demonology. He explains this in the opening to the book. He says, by damned, I mean all those documented historical facts which do not fit into existing conventional historical paradigms, such as the theory of uniformity and the theory of evolution by natural selection. Now, I'm a believer in evolution, a strong believer. But to me, evolution is adaptability to changing physical environments. Darwin, remember, when he talks about natural selection, he posits untold billions of years. Remember, Kate Sagan loved this. He was rightly hung out to dry because he loved to say all the time in Cosmos and other places, you know, everything takes place over millions and millions and billions of billions of years. And later, he denies ever saying this. And like everything Carl Sagan ever said, it's a dirty, stinking, obvious lie. It's a lie, which is why the liberal media and environment loved him so much, because in the scientific world, he squashed all these questions. And incidentally, liberal democracy has always had an inherent bias in favor of uniformitarianism, the idea that the universe has been safe for millions and billions and billions of years, like Carl Sagan said, and nothing ever changes. But look, we even see, we've just been very lucky. We had the COVID-19 pandemic, and hundreds of thousands of people died around the world from it. I've known people who died from it. I'm sure you do too. So that's not luck. But it could have been infinitely worse than it was. And just over 100 years ago, we had the great so-called Spanish influenza pandemic that swept the world. And even the name is a lie because Spain had nothing to do with it. Spain even then was carrying out national policies of controlling immigration into its country while the pandemic was going on. And the pandemic was far less bad for whatever reasons in Spain than it was in the United States. So, of course, American experts, enthusiastically supported by President Woodrow Wilson, called it the Spanish influenza. You can blame Spain, not the Wilson administration, for the pandemic. American hypocrisy and schizophrenia and scapegoatism are going again according to their old great traditions. But this was a catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands of people, proportionally a far larger proportion of the human race, died from it. I had an uncle, I was told, who died from it at the age of 19. And it was a large family. He was one of eight brothers and sisters. That's an Irish family for you in those days. And my mum and my aunties never talked about him, not because they wanted to forget him, but because they remembered him too well. They loved their brother. And his tragic death, not even in World War I, but from the Spanish flu, quote unquote, at age 19, was such a trauma that it became amnesia in that family. The memory was deliberately suppressed, and that's what people do. The closer we are to catastrophes, the more we want to deny that they ever happened. But we have to recognize they happened in order to protect ourselves against future ones and prepare to. And the best source of defense is to advance our science and advance our technology and to protect our population as best we can.
Well, I want to back you up there, Martin, because we ran an article the other day on Principia Scientific International. The title of the article is "Why Does the Left Consider This Documentary So Dangerous?" And the article is about the Ancient Apocalypse documentary on Netflix. It's really causing a stir. And you put yourself down too much, Martin. You say people don't take you seriously with the Bulikovsky idea. But the people do, grassroots people are waking up now, and they're aware of this thing. And the idea that there's a lost global civilization that existed about 12,000 years ago, it's catching the imagination of the public. They want to know more about it. As you say, it's being suppressed. It doesn't fit the mainstream narrative. And many people's careers have been built on the same kind of idea that Carl Sagan purports to, which is gradual evolution over millions of years. But as we've said on other shows, and as you said previously when you were on the show, there's another alternative theory, and it's very well backed up with evidence. And this documentary is doing just that.
Yes.
You know, the evidence is quite clear that, something unusual is happening. We've said it before in other programs that there are lost civilizations. Every culture seems to recognize that.
Yes, yes. Exactly. I mean, I love the Ancient Aliens television series. I think it's of a very high quality. If you look at the scholars, the historians, the former government officials who they have in as regulars on that show, it's astounding. It's astounding. I'm a huge personal admirer of Erich von Däniken. I loved his book when I came out, but I'm old enough to remember how the efforts to politically assassinate and personally discredit and even personally destroy von Däniken when his book came out. He was thrown in jail for years and convicted on totally spurious charges, which when you look at the details of them were childishly false. Transparently honorable and honest man. And unlike ghastly fake cult religious leaders in America who I've come across over the past 50 years, he never claimed to be infallible. When anyone has ever pointed out Mr. von Däniken, well, evidence proves this point is wrong and that point is wrong, he acknowledges and he says, yes, I was young, I made a mistake, I was overenthusiastic. Thank you for pointing it out to me.
Yeah.
And to have an honorable, courageous man like that to create a sea change in human perception globally is wonderful and necessary. And I think it's proof that in our human dimension, miracles still do exist. The forces of stupidity and cowardice and darkness and greed and hate are so great, and treachery. One can disperse it. But it's amazing how often people like Erich von Däniken and you and Joe and Velikovsky still manage to pop up.
Yep. Yep. Joe Olson, Joe Possible, do you want to add a few words to this?
Well, yeah, I can.
Yeah.
Just say that in Charles Darwin's book, The Voyage of the Beagle, he does record the aftermath of a giant tsunami that wiped out some villages on
yes.
the coast of Argentina. And then on the evolution point, yeah, so there is very small changes, slow term changes over millions of years. But to get wholesale new species, you need catastrophism for that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Joe Olson, another quick word from you.
Yeah, Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, 9,500 years before Christ. So we got a 12,000-year-old thing that they got to explain in their continuum of civilization. Yeah, I've read three of Graham Hancock's books. He's fabulous. I support him about 99%.
Yep. Martin Seif, we're coming to the end of the show. It's been such a pleasure having you on again. We touched on at the end on catastrophe theory. I know we're going to want you to come back again and talk some more on it. Will you come back in the new year? Promise us that. Would you do that for us?
If it's given to me, God willing. God, the universe, and fate. I have a Buddhist conception of those things. I'm not a Buddhist, but I have a huge risk. I'm not a practicing Buddhist, but I...